It's At the Letters for Thursday, August 1st, 2024. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson Smith. Our producers are Christian Ryan and Nick Ondrod. Congratulations, everybody, for making it through trade deadline season. And congratulations to Ben for making it through what was a crazy few days in Baltimore. Ben, you were on ground zero as players were coming, players were going. The Blue Jays were playing doubleheaders. There were rain delays, all kinds of stuff going on. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. has like one of the best days the Blue Jays has ever had in the history of the franchise. Nobody even talks about it.
He tattoos that ball to center. Couser back. That ball is gone. Right on cue. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. makes it 7-4.
What was it like just being around the club with all of this craziness going on?
Monday was wild. Those 2 days in Baltimore, the day before the deadline and the actual deadline day, they were both pretty wild. And to pull back the curtain a little bit, I flew in on the Monday thinking, okay, like the real action is probably, you know, later Monday, then I'll be there for the deadline Tuesday so I can really be, you know, set up and good to go. And so, you know, make my way to Baltimore. Everything is smooth enough for this, of course, doubleheader, as you mentioned. And then the trades just start happening. And so that day, which was initially going to be a bit more of a rival get situated day, it was like deals are going down. That was the day of the Kikuchi trade, of course, and others, I'm pretty sure. So that was super busy. And then, of course, by Tuesday, then I'm like, oh, okay, well, at least like all the action happened Monday. Like Tuesday is probably a little quieter, you know. So and it was for part of the day. And then all of a sudden it's, all right, Kiermaier's gone. Trevor Richards is gone. IKF is gone. So there was a ton of activity. It was fun. I mean, I think listeners of ATL know, I love trades. Trades, you know, it's fun. It's interesting to talk about, you know, the team building aspect of things. It's obviously difficult for the players on a personal level. And there were a lot of goodbyes. There were a lot of, you know, difficult moments. I think nothing shocking, but certainly some tough goodbyes at that point. But it's a fun time of year, I think, for baseball fans. And I think it was a much needed positive moment for the Blue Jays and for the Blue Jays fans to have something go well for them in a season where so few things have.
So what was it like then just being around, like what was the vibe? And I always hate that question, like what's the vibe in the clubhouse? But, you know, I was around it a bit when they played Texas at Rogers Center before they went to Baltimore, and being there on the day that like Danny Jansen was traded, that was really striking and just like how that impacted a lot of people and a lot of people that I wouldn't have even expected. Like I had like one, you know, Blue Jay who's like hasn't even been with the team for that long kind of came up to me and was like, what the hell? Like there it just like I guess because Danny was just like, he was pretty quiet, at least with us, like he was very professional and businesslike, and he wasn't exactly the most like exuberant outgoing person, so he didn't notice it as much, but he impacted like a lot of people in that organization. And after he was traded, I mean, you could see it in John Schneider's eyes that he was almost having trouble like keeping it together when he was talking to us. And people from the front office, like the business side of the front office, were coming down to the clubhouse to say goodbye to him. You know, Danny goes out on the field with his family to take some last photos, and the grounds crew is giving him a standing ovation. Like that, like just the mood around that one really struck me. So I'm curious if it was just how things struck you in Baltimore, as you said, as this sort of rapid fire of deals went down towards the deadline.
You know, nothing actually rose to that level of kind of emotional, just intensity. I think that for Justin Turner, he had been here for a few months and he knew there was a good chance that he would be traded. And so he was, of course, pulled out of the game. I'm kind of just remembering this right now. He was pulled out of the game, had the chance to say goodbye to his teammates. I asked him after, you know, did you get the chance to say goodbye to everyone? And he didn't get to say goodbye to the relievers. But then, of course, you look at the Blue Jays bullpen and it's like, I think he's okay maybe not saying a fond goodbye to Jose Quas. And
goodbye, Jose Quas. Goodbye, Yeri Rodriguez. Yeah. Big hug.
Yeah.
It was nice meeting you yesterday. Good luck.
You know, not sure that Justin Turner and Brandon Isard and Jose Quas were like, you know, spending tons and tons of time talking together. But in any case, that is not to say that he didn't have real relationships with the position players, with the coaching staff, with other people behind the scenes. Of course he did. Not trying to underestimate, hey, this was a difficult moment, but also at that point you're a day ahead of the deadline and he's a veteran. He's been around the game. He knew it was coming. And even with Yusei Kikuchi, later that day we spoke to Yusei Kikuchi as well. Even then he had no one, and you know this from his last, what, like 4 or 5 starts?
Yeah.
Like it was a topic. He was clearly, I don't want to say struggling with it. I'll say wrestling with it. He was wrestling with this reality that he was going to get traded. He knew it was going to happen. And so by the time it actually happened, he was mentally ready for it. And so it wasn't as emotional. He wasn't there with his family, for example. He wasn't there on his home stadium where he'd played all these games. So I think that being away from Toronto removes some of the emotional intensity from it. The fact that it was that much closer to the deadline, it's funny. Like I had heard via text from a source that Trevor Richards was traded to the Twins. So I tweeted this. I was in the dugout. And then my head was kind of down, right? You know this from when you're like trying to break news. Your head's like on your phone. You kind of have tunnel vision. You're not really looking at anyone else. And then I looked up after I tweeted it. I see Trevor Richards. He's on the phone, obviously talking to his agent or someone in his life, whatever the case. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that tracks. He's just finding out that he's been traded and trying to make sense of that. And he's 10 feet away from me. We're sitting there, the only two people in the dugout at Camden Yards. And yeah, so you get scenes like that, and it's a very, very different type of day. But honestly, I think the Jansen stuff was maybe the most emotionally intense of everything.
Yeah, it's a bit of that human element that I was talking about at the end of the last podcast. You know, you spend 6 months working with teammates and coaches and staff, and I mean, even some of us in the media who are around every single day, and you get quite close with these people, especially teammates who you're on buses and in hotels and having dinners with, and you're all like living this crazy traveling circus life together. And also the Blue Jays are were a pretty veteran team. Just, it really struck me as some of these trades were going down, Kevin Gausman said, you know, I'm not the only one losing friends with these trades. My daughters are losing friends. And there are a lot of fathers in that clubhouse and their kids all play together at the ballpark while dad's at work. Like we see them in the bowels of the stadium playing kickball and running around and having a good time. And, you know, like there are many kids of players who just lost friends, like just lost people that they spent days to days with, and their parents, you know, their fathers and mothers are having to explain to them like why so-and-so isn't around anymore and why they had to move. You know, Justin Turner has a newborn who didn't even have a passport yet. So Justin Turner's in Baltimore getting traded to Seattle. His wife Courtney's in Toronto with their newborn Beau. And Justin Turner's not even sure when Beau's going to have a passport and be able to travel. So Justin Turner now isn't sure when he's going to be able to see his like 3-week-old son. It's just, there are all kinds of like things that happen behind the scenes at a deadline. There are all kinds of like consequences of a trade that go beyond just, okay, Trevor Richards is going to be pitching for the Minnesota Twins in a couple of days. There's a lot of fallout that you don't see. So it is kind of like expected almost that things are going to be sort of somber and, you know, difficult around the team. As you said, like with Yusei Kikuchi, he wasn't only like, he was anxious, obviously, like he, as you said, right? Like he was uneasy about all this, but I also know his interpreter was anxious and uneasy about this. And his strength guy was anxious and uneasy about this. There's a lot more people that are affected by this than just the players.
Yeah, 100%. And it's a weird time because you see, say, someone like Justin Turner, who has his bags packed, he's ready to go, boom. Or Jimmy Garcia in Toronto, this is since our last podcast, but it feels like a long time ago now. Basically a week ago, he had already packed his entire you know, condo, apartment, wherever he was living in Toronto. It was packed. He was ready to go. And so you have all these individuals coming and going. At one point, I looked up and there was this dude who I didn't really recognize walking with the Jays director of team travel in and out of the clubhouse. I'm like, who is this? Who have the Jays acquired? And of course, it was Luis de los Santos, one of the infielders who came up and was added to their roster. And I just hadn't seen enough of him at spring to really fully clock who he was. So, you know, you have all these different things happening at once. And it is a very stressful time for even like, you know, 20 or no, this is like an hour before the trade deadline. Myself and Joe Siddle ran into Chad Green in the dugout tunnel at Camden Yards, and you just have a quick chat with him, and it's like, hey, you're still here, you're still a Blue Jay as far as you know. And he's like, yeah, as far as I know, you know, like I might change in 30 minutes. And so
he's like, you tell me.
Yeah, exactly. It's a time of huge uncertainty for these guys. So I think from that standpoint, it's probably a relief that it's done.
It's funny you mentioned Luis de los Santos, who, like, he was an international signing in July signing period of 2015 as a 17-year-old out of Dominican Republic, spends the better part of a decade, almost 10 years, like, just persistently climbing the ranks of the Blue Jays organization, touching like just every level of the ladder, spending time at all of the affiliates, and you know, finally he breaks through, gets his big league call up at the age of 26 to go meet the Blue Jays in Baltimore. Like, what a special moment, what a cool moment, what a great story that we'd all be telling and talking about. But it's like number 15 on the list of things that have happened in the last 72 hours.
Oh, yeah. There are so many. Like you said, with Vlad Jr. too, like, he had that monster doubleheader. He homered in 8 of the 12 games leading up to the trade deadline. Yeah. Like, just an absolute hot streak. Under other circumstances, we'd be talking about that, or we'd be talking about, you know, the departure. Like, there's so many different stories to tell here. And of course, you just can't get to them all because there's so much going on. And even with the newcomers, right? Like, I know, because we were talking about it off air, you and I have both been trying to research and gather as much info as we can about these guys and learn about them, but they acquired 14 players, right? Like, this is not, along with the 8 departures, there are 14 new players. You think about a draft, that's 20 rounds. So, and Ryan Yarbrough, not exactly a prospect. Let's say 13, though. So you're getting 2/3 of a draft added to your organization. And some of those guys will flame out and never reach the majors. And some of those will be role players. And maybe some of them will be a lot more than that. We'll see. But it is a huge, huge shift for this organization, and a massive infusion of young players and ideally of young talent to this organization that they needed. And now that they have.
Yeah, the Blue Jays, like, between the draft and this trade deadline, they've turned over, someone was telling me, about 25% of their minor league system. So, like, the Blue Jays, and remember, organizations are limited to 165 players in their organization. So in the coming days, the Blue Jays are going to be releasing a lot of minor leaguers. Like, speak about the fallout from the trade deadline that we don't think of. Like, there's a lot of current players in the Blue Jays system, organizational players, who are going to be out of jobs in a few days. The Blue Jays have already culled a bunch of complex league players, some international guys, like, in the lead up to the deadline, anticipating that they were going to bring in players. But I don't even think that, like, some people in the Blue Jays development staff were thinking they were going to have 14 spots that they were going to have to create. So, like, you're right, it was needed. They needed to raise the floor of the system. They needed to replace that layer of depth in AAA that was completely eroded this year. But it is a little bit of, like, an overlooked consequence of acquiring this many players that you need to make room for them in your system. And also, to your other point, like, the last few days for me, yeah, have been about, okay, like, trying to figure out who some of these guys are and send some texts and dig into things. And like you said, like, yeah, I just haven't figured anything out about RJ Schreck yet. Like, I just can't even really tell you much about him that isn't on his baseball reference page. You know, I have, like, one note on Jay Harry. Like, someone told me that he's talented, and I still need to kind of follow up on, like, what exactly, like, did you mean? Like, what were you referring to in particular? Because it's just, like, such a shotgun blast of various players. So I have some stuff on some players, and, like, we'll get to some of those more particulars, but, you know, maybe if you have anything to say about what I just said, go ahead. But otherwise, I am curious to hear kind of your big picture thoughts on how the Blue Jays did at this deadline.
Jay Herre ranked 89th among the 89 players traded by Baseball America. So that is pretty harsh. He's got some doubters to prove wrong.
I mean, what's the difference between 59th and 89th on that list, really? You know?
Yeah. Well,
beauty's in the eye of the beholder.
That certainly is this time of year. So yeah, so big picture with the Blue Jays, I honestly think they had a really good deadline. I think that this was exactly, well, I'm not going to say it was exactly what they needed to do, because there's room for debate as far as the scale of things and whether they could have gone further, and I'm here for that, and we'll get to that. But I think if we're looking at the actual moves that happened, this was really good. They traded away guys who were not going to help them beyond this year, with two exceptions, IKF and Nate Pearson. And they got back a lot. Like, there is real talent here. There's real, you think about Jake Bloss as someone who has been described to me as a potential mid-rotation starter in the major leagues. He has great numbers in the minors. He has good stuff, four-pitch mix, big fastball that maybe plays up beyond the 93 to 95 due to the way that he throws it and the extension he can get. Then you got Joey Loperfido. You've got Jonathan Class A. These guys have already reached the major leagues. They have seemingly the floor of being a fourth outfielder and the upside to be a bit more. And we have more prospects that we can get to that are further down that list, starting probably with Charles McAdoo, who has a lot of power. But big picture, I think you added real talent. The Blue Jays added real talent to the organization. They gave up players that really it's totally fine to give up, and they should be giving up those guys. And so it's a major step forward. Obviously, it happens in the context of a dismal season, of a very disappointing season, one that Ross Atkins and any fan all agree is unacceptable and not where the Blue Jays want it to be. But under those circumstances, I think they had a really, really good week. I think that this was a big necessary step forward and a big positive for the Blue Jays.
Yeah, and you know, we all have to accept, like, the Blue Jays season will go down as a failure
yes,
as it pertains to their goals entering it. So it's a failed season. Like, nobody's trying to move the goalposts or, you know, say this was a successful season for the Blue Jays. It was not. They intended to do better this year than they had last year. They intended to go to the postseason. They intended to win postseason games. None of those things are going to happen. They intended to have, like, you know, young players in their minor league system, like, take steps and make big league debuts, like some of their top prospects. And, you know, many of those individuals ended up, like, either not playing as well as you might have expected, or they had really major surgeries, or in one case, they were suspended 80 games for a performance enhancing drug. So, like, not a good season for the Blue Jays, and no one is saying that. All of that on the table, I do think it was a successful deadline for the Blue Jays. I do think that they made the most of this poor situation that they are in. And I think that in the Yusei Kikuchi deal in particular, I mean, they just got a tremendous return for, you know, 2 months of a pending free agent starter who really, like, the Blue Jays just had no use for over the next 2 months. For them to return, as you said, like, somebody with the, you know, like Bloss, who it sounds like you can reasonably expect to be, like, perhaps at worst, like, a back of the rotation starter, upside of, like, a number three, plus a Loperfido who has, you know, a ton of speed and plays a bunch of different positions, really versatile, and a little bit of sneaky power in there as well. Left-handed hitter really helps them. And then also Will Wagner, who's really interesting to me, just in terms of, like, the approach and the kind of the shape of what he does at the plate. If you take his chase rate, his contact rate, his hard hit rate from this year at AAA, mind you, and compare it to Justin Turner's in the majors, like, those numbers between Wagner and Turner are off by one percentage point at the most.
Yeah.
He's like a very similar profile to a Turner in terms of hard hit, contact, and chase, and those are three things that Turner does pretty well. So it is, like, it's pretty remarkable how similar just the strike zone management, the bat to ball, the barrel control is between the two. And we know that advanced approach, that contact ability, those are two traits that the Blue Jays value very highly. As it pertains to this Kikuchi deal, I mean, like, when you heard it, when things started coming out and we're kind of reporting this thing in real time, what was your reaction? Like, how did you feel about this deal for the Blue Jays?
So initially, the first thing that I was able to kind of confirm, I think it came from Jim Bowden, that Kikuchi was likely headed to the Astros. And so the first thing that I was that I could confirm was that there were indeed advanced talks happening between the Blue Jays, and this is alongside Shadavidi. We're sitting in the Baltimore Camden Yards press box there and kind of comparing notes on this. And so initially we hear, there are advanced talks and sounds like Bloss would come back and, you know, this is, there's some traction here. So great. And at that point, I'm thinking, well, Bloss is pretty good. You're looking at the numbers. He was ranked 92nd, I want to say, by Eric Longenhagen of Fangraphs among all prospects. This is someone who's reached the major leagues. Young guy, just drafted last year. Really good numbers, really good stuff. Like, this is a good, you want this player. Everyone in baseball wants this player. And so initially I'm thinking, well, maybe the Jays are sending something else back to Houston to get this deal done if you're getting Bloss. And so I literally break out my binoculars and Shy and I are kind of like, okay, yeah, Yenesis Cabrera is still out there. Chad, like we're trying to see to make sure that there wasn't some reliever that had kind of snuck into the clubhouse. Because I'm thinking that to get Bloss, it might be a 2-for-1. Then later, Shy and I hear, oh, it's actually a 3-for-1 and the Blue Jays are getting the other players back. And honestly, if the Jays had traded Yusei Kikuchi and Yenesis Cabrera to get Jake Bloss, I'd be sitting here right now and saying that's a good trade. I really would. Right. Because Jake Bloss is a top 100 prospect. You get that for a rental? Great. That's a good thing. But as it turned out, this was a, I mean, it wasn't just the Blue Jays, to be fair. Like the Marlins to get Connor Norby and Kyle Stowers for Trevor Rogers. Like, whoa, that's just an outrageous haul for a guy who's even, like, definitely worse than Yusei Kikuchi. That's a weird one by, I mean, I guess I sort of get it for Baltimore. But anyways, on the topic of the of that trade for the Blue Jays, I think it's a great trade. I was surprised that they were able to get as much as they did. It was a seller's market, but they took full advantage. And, you know, it's really interesting because you compare this to some of those other trades out there, and the Orioles gave up a lot to get Rogers. But for example, with the Dodgers and Jack Flaherty, the Dodgers actually paid a lesser price, and the Tigers did not get nearly as much for Jack Flaherty as the Blue Jays got for Yusei Kikuchi. So I think the Jays did really, really, really well here. I think this was their best trade. And this isn't just my opinion. This is from talking to other people with other teams. The consensus in the industry is that the Blue Jays did very well.
Yeah, my quick backstory on that is, so I was kind of on standby with Sportsnet Central to do a hit with them. And so I'm kind of telling them, like, hey, like, there's going to be a Kikuchi trade going down in a few minutes. Like, let's just hold off on this. Like, yeah, okay, we'll wait. And then it comes out that it's Kikuchi and Bloss that are kind of the framework of it. And then, you know, we're all hearing, like, the deal's not done. There's still more to come here. So I'm thinking the same thing as you, right? And I'm pretty sure I'd, like, messaged you and Shy, just like, do you think Chad Green's in this? Like, what's going on here? Is there money going from the Jays to the Astros? Like, what's the holdup here? The last thing I ever thought was that it was the Astros sending two more players to the Jays and, like, two players of a pretty good caliber, like, not just, you know, throw in lottery ticket prospects, but one guy who's already proven himself as being a big leaguer, and like another guy in in Wagner, who, like, all the Blue Jays believe is ready to play in the big leagues. So, like, I was somewhat blown away by that, and almost to the point that, so the deal gets done and I'm on, you know, Sportsnet Central with Faisal Kamisa, like, literally a minute later after this deal gets done, and I got really gun shy because I thought, like, I must be missing something here. Like, there's no, I'm surely, like, I just haven't thought about this enough. I'm overlooking something. Like I said, look, I think the Blue Jays have done well here. I think this is a good deal for the Jays. I would have thought it was good if it was just Kikuchi for Bloss, but I didn't go to the level that then you heard from other people in the ensuing day or two of, like, this is an absurd return. And this is, like, what are the Astros thinking? Like, this is crazy. This is super lopsided. Like, that just kind of speaks to me to how almost a shock it was to see, like, what the Astros gave up for Kikuchi. At first, I just didn't trust myself. I thought, I must be missing something here because it just doesn't really make sense to me that the Astros would give up this much.
And you weren't alone in thinking that. I mean, I was able to see some of the Houston fan reaction, and I don't know how much you saw of that, but man, they are pissed at Dana Brown, the GM of the Astros, for giving this up. to get Yusei Kikuchi. And it might be, they might get 10 starts of Yusei Kikuchi. So that's a lot of pressure on Yusei too, by the way.
Yeah.
And it wasn't lost on him that, you know, they gave up a lot to get him.
He's not going to be popular in Houston if it does not go well. I'll tell you that.
It's going to be. I really hope for Yusei Kikuchi that it goes well because he works so hard. He's a fun pitcher. You know, I hope that he succeeds there. I really do. We'll see what happens. But it's not just the Astros fan base. You look at the Tigers fan base and some of the reaction to they had Jack Flaherty. Why didn't they get that deal for Jack Flaherty? And it seems as though the Dodgers kind of played the Tigers a little bit and were able to just wait them out because and maybe it was smart on the Blue Jays part to jump first and to take that Houston offer. But ultimately, they were going to get a good package for Yusei Kikuchi one way or the other. They had multiple teams interested, as you would expect. And he was their best trade chip. I mean, Jimmy Garcia had good value, too. Class A is a real return there. But Yusei had a ton of value. And the starting pitching market was wild. I mean, there was a lot of talent changing hands for any competent starting pitcher.
Yeah, it was pretty ideal market conditions for the Blue Jays to sell Kikuchi. As you said, like he had a very strong market. Like the Twins were in, I think the Brewers were in. Obviously, like the Astros just like went above and beyond where anyone else was going to go. Like the Astros, by the way, like proposed this trade. Like they put this on the table. This wasn't, you know, the Blue Jays obviously like framed what they were looking for, but it was the Astros who proposed this trade and the Blue Jays who said yes. So to me, that suggests like just how much the Astros wanted Yusei Kikuchi. Like I believe he was just number one on their list, and he was the guy that they really, really wanted. And clearly, like they're not stupid. Like they understand the price they paid and they understand they're going to get crushed on Fangraphs for it. But, you know, this is the position that they're in and they obviously were comfortable with that price. You also look at just the market conditions in general. Like you mentioned, you know, there's really high prices going for starting pitchers because there was a bit of a lack of supply in really capable starters who you would feel comfortable like starting a playoff game for you on the market. And, you know, in an interesting kind of twist, the pending free agents, like you say, almost had more value than the like older, more expensive, controllable guys on this market. And I know you wrote about this today and I totally agree with you. Yusei Kikuchi had more value than a Chris Bassett, even though that seems counterintuitive. But like there were a lot of teams that just like couldn't really take on a ton of money and wouldn't have been willing to sign up for Bass's $21 million next year, but would have given up more for what's left of Kikuchi's salary this year, to say nothing of the fact that, you know, you say Kikuchi's profiles is much more of a playoff starter that you feel really strongly about than Bassett would.
Yeah, agreed. Like, and this is worth getting into because the Bassett stuff is a topic that fans care about, and I have some thoughts there. I'm sure you do as well. But
sure.
When we're comparing Yusei Kikuchi and Chris Bassett here, there are two things in play. There's the pitcher and there's the contract. So let's talk about the contract. Yusei Kikuchi earning $10 million, Chris Bassett earning $21 million, and then $21 million next year. And control is always a good thing. If you have a player who's under control for five more years, that's better than four, that's better than three, and so on. So you want control, but the price is going to be an impediment for some teams when you're talking about $21 million. Keep in mind that you have teams in the industry right now that some of them don't spend. The Marlins, I think, have a functional payroll right now of like $13 million. Not that they were a buyer, but you know, you do have some teams out there that don't spend and would require significant ownership clearance to add that kind of money. And this is the Twins would be an example of this that fall into that category, where Bassett just doesn't really enter the landscape for them because of his money. So that means that Yusei Kikuchi at $10 million is just much more palatable, much more easy to acquire. You don't have to go to ownership. It's a simple addition. So boom, on that level, Yusei Kikuchi has more value. Then you get to the fact that Yusei Kikuchi is also a more desirable pitcher. And this is someone who can slot into an October start. He can pitch in the division series for you. He can pitch in the ALCS for you. No problem. Bassett could too. But the difference is that if you need someone to come in out of the bullpen, like Chris Bassitt is not a reliever. He's not that kind of, he's not a Max Scherzer who's going to come out throwing 96 with a nasty slider. Like Bassitt is a starting pitcher. He's a mix and match, keep you off balance, give you the innings. That's his value. And that value is really useful in the regular season and less useful in the postseason. So you say profiles better as a postseason weapon on a pitching staff.
Yeah, power plays in the postseason. And this is just like another reminder of I'm not saying the results don't matter, but like how little they like are weighed in to some of these calculations at the trade deadline. Because a lot of people pointed to Yusei Kikuchi's struggles like leading up to the deadline over his last 6 to 8 starts. And like just objectively, Chris Bassitt's having a better season than Yusei Kikuchi. He has more war. He has a lower ERA. He's thrown more innings. Like Chris Bassitt has been better this year than Kikuchi just in 2024. Obviously, Kikuchi from like he had that run from mid-23 to mid-24 where he was like one of the best pitchers on the planet. But we just don't really measure things from mid-season to mid-season. We contextualize them within one season. So in 2024, Chris Bassitt's been better, but like, to your point, Chris Bassitt's value is the 170, 180 innings of like a 3.6 to 3.8 ERA that he gives you over 32 starts to get you to the postseason. And then when you're in the postseason, you'd much rather have Yusei Kikuchi throw a 98 from the left side with multiple breaking weapons that get swing and miss just two trips through and see you later. Like Chris Bassitt's a guy who like you got no problem, you know, taking three trips through in the regular season. We've seen him start fourth trips with the Blue Jays. Like Kikuchi, you're not looking for three trips from him in the playoffs. You want him to just go and mow dudes down two trips through, or if he's out of your bullpen, like he's targeting a pocket of lefties situationally, and he's a really tough look for them in the middle or even late in a really tight ball game. It also speaks to just like how much teams don't really care about what you've done. Like they really care about what they believe you're going to do and what their model projects you are going to do. And Yusei Kikuchi's stuff by like just the velocity, the movement, the contact it gets in the zone, the chase it gets, the swing and miss it gets, like the release, the shape of the pitches, like all of these things that play into a model. Teams are going to look at that and say, oh, Yusei Kikuchi's a better bet going forward, even though he hasn't had a better season than Chris Bassitt to this point. Like teams really only care about what their models project going forward. So Yusei Kikuchi's like 6 or 7 starts leading into the trade deadline where he gave up some runs and got hit around. It's not entirely irrelevant, but it's like it's shades, it's hairs from being irrelevant.
Yeah, exactly. And we see this time of year, like we see pro scouts, right? And they're in the press box with us. You see them in the scout seats and they're there watching this through the lens of, all right, like let's say, to pick an example, let's say you're trying to make your way through Alec Boehm, Bryce Harper, Kyle Schwarber, something like that, you know, top of the Phillies order, and it's the World Series and your season's on the line. Who do you want on your pitching staff in that moment? And I mean this with all due respect to Chris Bassitt, but if it's the 6th inning of Game 5 or 6 of the World Series, are you going to Chris Bassitt in that situation and hoping that he can mix and match his way through that order? Or are you going to Yusei Kikuchi and giving Kyle Schwarber a really tough look from the left side and then Harper's up and it's a really tough look from the left side? To me, that's where the value of Yusei Kikuchi is. And, you know, he was struggling, but he wasn't struggling to throw 96 with nasty breaking stuff. It's just that the results, as far as the actual game on the field, weren't good. But he wasn't struggling to throw nasty stuff. He wasn't struggling to repeat his delivery. He wasn't struggling to go out there and take the mound and be healthy. So from that standpoint, Kikuchi had a ton of value. And this is why the Blue Jays were able to get what they got. And I think, you know, him and Flaherty, those are the two guys that to me had the most value amongst the pitchers who actually got traded. And I'm surprised the Tigers didn't get a little bit more for Flaherty. I'm surprised that the Marlins got what they got for Trevor Rogers, so I don't even think is that good, and it's probably a number 5 or number 6 in my opinion, but good for them. I mean, it's not every day you get to fleece the Orioles in a trade, so good for Miami. But, you know, to me, this does bring back to, okay, so in my view, the Jays, like, they were never going to get anything close to what they got for Kikuchi for Chris Bassett. It's not like they could have copy and pasted and done that times two for Chris Bassett. But could they have gotten something for Chris Bassett in this market? I think they probably could. I don't know what was on the table for him. I was told that they weren't shopping him, so I don't think they were soliciting offers. I don't even know if they got any offers late in the game for Chris Bassett. But I think it would have been something worth exploring. To me, it would have been worth seeing what you can get. And yet, you know, here we are.
Yeah, the Blue Jays were only shopping their pending free agents. And by shopping, I mean going to other teams and suggesting trades. On anyone else, like other teams had to come to the Blue Jays and propose them. And they had set like very distinct values on each of their players. And they kind of had a line where if the return crossed the line of value where they felt like they were getting surplus in return, then they'd consider it. And they would think about like how this would position them going forward and whether or not this made sense and how much they really liked the guys who were coming back with that value. So I'm sure they received proposals for Chris Bassett. I would assume so. But clearly it didn't cross that line. Whereas like the Pittsburgh Pirates did cross the line for Isaiah Kiner-Falefa and the Chicago Cubs did cross the line for Nate Pearson. So to me, that's the difference.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we'll see if they end up competing next year and Chris Bassett's a part of that rotation and he's someone who can help them push for a playoff spot and reach the playoffs, which that is his skill set, is to give you those innings, then great. Then they'll look back at this and they'll say it was a good thing they didn't trade him. I tend to think, knowing only what we know now, that it still would have been an opportunity to trade Chris Bassett and Chad Green in a seller's market and really just push it that much further. But that's, you know, that's just one person's opinion. The Blue Jays decided not to do that. And they still ended up with a really, really, really good haul. They still augmented their organization. And the trades that they did make were broadly very strong.
And my one final thought on the Kikuchi deal, like I've kind of talked a bit about how my thinking has evolved. Like when it first happened, I thought I was missing something. And then you kind of talk to some people and kind of think about it and sit down with it. And you're like, wow, like what were the Astros doing? And now I've kind of like come around to this actually makes sense for both sides. Like clearly the Jays win the value exchange in this trade. Like by far. But, you know, congratulations. Go raise your value accrual banner. You know, the Astros are going to try to raise a World Series banner, and they realize where they're at in their competitive cycle. And they realize that this is their last year with Alex Bregman, and, you know, Kyle Tucker is going to be a free agent after next year. They realize Jose Altuve isn't getting any younger. Like they needed pitching desperately because of the injuries that they've suffered. They know this is their last year with Justin Verlander and whatever he's still going to be able to give them. So they're going to like lose this trade via the nerds, right? Like they're going to lose the value. They're going to give up value, understanding that. And they're going to get crushed on Fangraphs, like I said, for that. And then they're going to go out and try to reach their ninth straight ALCS. Right?
Yeah.
And they're going to try to play for their third World Series championship in that span. Maybe it's just eight straight ALCSs. Either way, like it's a remarkable run. They are the American League's dynasty of the last decade. So just like count the rings when you want to talk about, you know, how much value the Blue Jays gained in this and how much the Blue Jays fleeced them. Like you even talk about the Trevor Rogers deal, right? Like the Orioles give up Connor Norby and Kyle Stowers. Yeah, the Orioles lost that deal on value, and Peter Bendix made like an extremely Rays-esque deal where he brought in a ton of value, and like that's what he, you know, Miami got him to do because they don't want to spend a lot of money and they want someone to run them like the Rays, and Miami can enjoy all that future surplus that Peter Bendix acquired at this deadline while losing 100 games after making the playoffs last year. Meanwhile, the Orioles are going to go and they're looking at a second straight 100 win season and potentially a buy into the DS. So you can kind of look at the franchises that are really good at accruing value over time, like the Guardians, the Rays, etc. And they've had success. Certainly, they've gathered a lot of value. They've been to postseasons. But how many rings do they have? How many division titles do they have? You know, like the Astros know they have money to spend. They are at towards the end of a pretty dynastic run. They have a great track record of acquiring and developing young, cost-controlled pitching. they'll be fine. They can lose this trade and maybe just win a World Series.
Yeah, I get it. I get the intention, and it might pay off. And Houston certainly has done a lot of things well. To me, I still actually prefer what the Guardians did, where it's like, all right, well, I guess we'll just get Alex Cobb and like hope he's good. I actually prefer that, because then you're not giving up these players. And with the Orioles, I guess I get it a bit more, because with Baltimore, they have so many young position players that you actually can afford to give up a Norby and a Stowers, especially Stowers. Like, it's going to be fine.
They never seem that high on Stowers, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I get the Orioles one. I still don't like this trade for the Houston Astros. I think to me at that point, just get Alex Cobb. Just get someone, get a warm body, get Ryan Yarbrough. Just, you know, don't give up your farm. But I would say this, maybe there was a case to be made to give up even more and go out and get Garrett Crochet, or give up even more and go out and get Tarek Skubal. Now, the price for Skubal presumably would have been something like Kobe Mayo and Jackson Holliday, or for, I don't even know if the Astros could have made a real offer for Tarek Skubal. The Dodgers probably could have. It would have been just absurd. There are not a lot of teams that have that kind of talent. And so, you know, it's a tricky one. But at a certain point, like, just push in a little further and get someone who's going to be a core player for you moving forward.
Sure. We should step away because we've been going on for a while. But when we continue, I've got some more granular thoughts on some of the players that the Blue Jays acquired at this deadline. Then we should probably figure out where the Blue Jays go from here now that all this activity is behind them. All that and so much more when we continue on At the Letters.
Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson Smith. Our producers are Nick Andrade and Christian Ryan. Thanks to them for their work. Thank you so much for listening. Ben, let's get a little bit more granular just on a couple of the players that the Blue Jays got in return at the deadline here. Don't know that we have time for 14 of them, but certainly for one or two here. And like, it's kind of interesting, you know, if you look at some of the post deadline sort of analysis, reaction, recaps of what happened, I think that Jake Bloss is going to be towards the top of the list of prospects that were moved and, you know, players that the Blue Jays acquired. I think a lot of people would have him towards the top as far as the Blue Jays go. And, you know, for good reason. And he's very young and he's already made his big league debut and he's got this like great high spin efficiency fastball with this like delivery from, you know, a low point that like flattens the approach angle, gets him a lot of swing and miss, like really high whiff rates on that fastball with like the ride that he gets up in the zone. So he gets a lot of swing and miss in the zone with that pitch, and like he just looks like a really solid pickup for the Blue Jays. But all that said, I kind of wonder, and just through talking to some people, if the Blue Jays aren't more excited about Jonathan Class A, and if the Blue Jays internally were ranking it, they might say that Jonathan Class A is actually like the prize of this deadline for them.
Wow. Yeah, that's super interesting. And I haven't had anyone rank the entire haul for me, so I'm not sure exactly what that would look like. Obviously, both would be toward the top of the list, and I think you're totally right to say that Bloss, from an industry standpoint, would be viewed as kind of the eye-popping, like, whoa, they got him, top 100 guy. But hey, Class A is like really interesting, right? He's a smaller guy. He's super, super fast. He's said to have raw power. Whether that can translate into games, we'll kind of see here. He's had strikeout issues, much like Lo Profito. So, you know, we'll see if he can make consistent enough contact to really make that speed play up and get the most out of his entire skill set. But this is a guy who's already made the major leagues. He's had success in the upper minors. Like, he's a very interesting player.
Yeah, I know this. The Blue Jays love athletes. They love guys with big tools. And they definitely feel like Class A has as much upside as anyone that they acquired. Now, it's going to take a lot for him to fulfill that upside. Like, I would say that Bloss is like probably a safer bet. Like, you know, the Blue Jays have a model that analyzes pitchers' deliveries and you know, just how they move athletically on the mound and some of the things that they believe project to durability in the future. And like Bloss checks a lot of those boxes just in terms of his like mechanics and, you know, just how athletic that he is in his delivery. Like the Blue Jays believe like at his age with what he's done to this point that he's going to be very durable. He's going to just continue to improve. He's got a lot of kind of runway to continue refining, you know, an approach on the mound that already isn't particularly effortful, but like Class A, while he probably has more work to do and like more development ahead of him, he is a rawer prospect. I think probably there's a lot of people who believe he could ultimately be the best player in this hall just because of, as you mentioned, the absolutely like elite speed. This is a guy who ranks fourth among all minor leaguers in stolen bases since the start of 2023. He's got like a 79 steal season. We've seen max exit velos over 110 at AAA. You know, Zips projects him to hit 17 homers in the big leagues next year with semi-regular playing time. And when you look at just like the speed and the athleticism, if he's able to refine the feel a little bit and just get some more reps in the outfield, get more comfortable, I think there's really a belief that he could be an elite defender and that he could be like really solid at any of the three outfield positions. So there's a lot of work to be done, and a lot of this will just depend on how good his bat becomes. But I think that the Blue Jays see a lot of upside there, and I think it really says something that they moved pretty early in this deadline with Jimmy Garcia as soon as Class A was put on the table.
Exactly. I think a lot of the time the actual timing of these deals tells us something about what the teams feel about them, right? Like, you're not making that trade on the Friday before a Tuesday deadline, unless you really like the return, unless you really think that Class A can be something for you. And I think it's worth saying with all of these trades that a lot of the time, it's just worth checking in and saying, like, we're not talking about superstar returns here. The right superstars, usually those guys are signed internationally or drafted usually toward the top of the draft. And, you know, if you're picking five or seven, or if you spend a lot on a Venezuelan kid, that's where you have a shot to get a superstar. And if Bloss becomes like legit a number three starter, that's huge. That's a great trade for the Jays. If Class A can become Jose Siri with a worse arm, that's probably good for the Jays. Like, Jose Siri is someone who has elite speed and who strikes out a lot and who does make the most of his speed to be a really, really, really good center fielder. That's not something that we've seen from Class A. He has the speed. He has not been a good defender. He's not described as someone who's a good defender at this point in his career because he doesn't get the right jumps. He doesn't take the right routes. That's something that you can work on. That's why he's still a work in progress and not a finished product here. But, you know, just for the sake of setting fan expectations, and other people might differ in their opinion from me on this, and I'm sure people within the Blue Jays would disagree with this take, but to me, if Class A becomes Jose Siri with a worse arm, that's pretty good. That's a good return for 2 months of a reliever.
Oh yeah, 100%. You didn't get Kyle Tucker, you know?
Like, no.
You didn't get Jordan exactly. Alvarez, right?
Right.
You
got, so just to be clear, that's not what we're talking about here.
Oh, no, yeah, 100%. Like, even, you know, you look at, like Blue Jays fans are going to see a lot of Joey Loperfido in the next 2 months. Like, he's got some pretty direct pass to everyday playing time, and he's been, like, somewhat of a late bloomer in his career, honestly. You know, somebody who's kind of, like, come into his strength a bit later. I don't know, what do you think, like, best case scenario, like, league average outfielder, you know, more realistically probably a fourth outfielder who moves around the diamond a lot. Like, that's probably what we're looking at here. Like, we're looking at somebody who's like right around a 100 weighted runs created plus and playing pretty decent defense and stealing you some bases, like a regular part of your roster in a good scenario. Like, we're not talking about somebody who's going to develop into prime George Springer here.
Right, exactly. And I think if you got a 100 WRC plus and pretty good outfield defense from Loperfido, like, lock that in. That would be great. That would be as the second best part of the return for a 2 month rental. That would be phenomenal if the Blue Jays end up getting that out of Loperfido.
Yeah, I think the hit rate on prospects at the deadline is like particularly low if you went back
Yeah, and J.J. Cooper has done some research on this dating back to 2015, and I might have the numbers a little bit off because they weren't in front of me, but I think there were hundreds and hundreds of prospects traded in the course of the last decade, and the research showed that 40% of them never made the major leagues, and another 40% of them accrued one WAR or less in the major leagues. So 80% are going to give you less than one WAR in the major leagues. And that's okay. So say for the Blue Jays, they acquire 13 prospects. Maybe they have three who end up accruing more than one WAR and actually becoming meaningful major league contributors. Maybe it's more. I think the Blue Jays would say there are a lot of guys who have a chance, whether it's Coffee, whether it's McAdoo, a lot of guys who have a chance to break through that threshold. And this was a good deadline. So they maybe this is one of those exceptions, but it's not going to be 13. Let's, you know, it's not going to be eight. It might be five, you know, it might be one, but it's not going to be nine of them.
No, it's important to keep expectations in check, certainly. Like, so, like one person said to me the other day that like Edinson Paulino could be a really like sleeper acquisition in this deal. He was like the other player along with Cutter Coffey who came over from the Red Sox for Danny Jansen. You know, 22, he's a left-handed hitter. He can play anywhere on the infield. And like he's seen as someone who makes really above average swing decisions. Like he controls the strike zone really well. Blue Jays believe he has room to tap into more power. Like they feel like he's a bit of a overlooked acquisition and a sleeper there. But that's in the context of like, hey, this guy may one day develop into like a bench utility player. Wouldn't that be great? You know, like that's the ceiling here. Like we get on the Blue Jays a lot about you know, their track record of drafting and development recently, and fairly, I think. But I think the Blue Jays would point to guys like Davis Schneider and Spencer Horwitz, Leo Jimenez, Addison Barger, even like a Stuart Baroa as, hey, those are guys that, you know, these aren't first round picks. Like those are guys that we drafted and developed into big leaguers. Like even though they are average to maybe even below average big leaguers, like those are even seen as success stories because it is the like rarest of the rare, the like 1% of the 1% who actually become like superstars year over year over year in this league.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that those are successes and have a chance to emerge as even greater successes. And I think on the position player side, the Blue Jays have had more developmental success. You know, not to go back to the whole draft topic here, but I do think that on the pitching side, it's just really light. It's just really, really light to me. I mean, people might view it differently. I just think you look at the pitching that the Blue Jays have developed, there's not a lot there. There's not a lot in the system right now. And so, you know, with the importance of pitching, that to me is a real question. It's actually kind of interesting because at this deadline, the Jays went into it knowing they need pitching. And they were saying this on the record. I'm sure if they had shared their thoughts off the record as well, like it was an apparent need that this organization needed pitching. They go out and they acquire Bloss and one other pitcher, Batista, I think. And otherwise, it was 11 of the prospects that they acquired were position players. And I'm not saying that that's like a problem. I just think it's interesting because if the talent that you could get was position players, that's fine. I mean, you just have to take the talent that you can get and you can make those switches later and trade guys or figure things out. But I did think it was interesting for a team that needs pitching as much as it does, for a team that hasn't developed pitching very well in the last decade, to not add pitching at this juncture was, I thought, fascinating.
Yeah, it was interesting. Let me put it this way, because this just came to mind as well. Like Alek Manoah, 11th overall pick in 2019, him having the 2022 season that he did, right? Like nearly 200 innings. He was like a 5-win player, like, you know, Cy Young finalist. If he never pitches for the Blue Jays again, that's already a successful draft pick.
Yes.
Right?
100%. Like,
and I don't know that a lot of people would think about it that way, but outside of the industry, but like within baseball, that's already a smashing success. Anything that comes afterwards now is just bonus.
Yeah, I would say at least it's more than what you would expect. If you were to go back and average out the contributions for players taken in that slot with at that draft position, it would be above the average. So, yeah, I think that when it comes to the trade return, maybe it didn't end up helping the pitching side of things. But to me, this sets in motion an offseason where they're probably going to end up trading some of their position players to help on the pitching side. And that's okay. You can do that in the offseason. And I don't know who that's going to be. I'm sure they'll have lots and lots of conversations, and there's still time to play this season. The next 2 months do matter. They will inform how things play out. But I think there's a very real chance we see them do a position player for pitching trade.
Yeah. And, you know, some of the players that the Blue Jays acquired at this deadline could be part of those trades is the thing. Some of these guys might not be Blue Jays for very long. Like, I would, honestly wouldn't even be surprised, because they like they got some guys back who are going to be within their top 20, top 30 prospects for, you know, for whatever that means to you. And so those are some of the players who could be part of the trades for a pitcher or for a catcher this offseason. You know, I think part of the context as well is that the Blue Jays first round pick this year, Trey Savage, who signed here on Thursday, August the 1st, and is now officially a Blue Jay, is someone who can move very, very quickly. Like, I was told that he has just now stuff. Like, it is big league ready, and it's just going to be about getting him accustomed to professional routines and the lifestyle and, you know, just kind of how to go about it and thinking about his workload coming out of college and all that. But I mean, he's coming out of like a very good professional program in East Carolina. He's very polished. You know, he's got the frame for it, 6'4", 225. And like, I think he'll start at a very high level with the Blue Jays next year. I'd be surprised if he pitched again in 2024. Like, I don't think the Blue Jays think he needs to pitch anymore this year. He's already got a bunch of innings, and he's got a good like basis to build from. I think he threw like almost 95 innings this year in college. But like the belief is that like the mid-90s riding fastball is ready, like the slider, the curveball, the splitter, he's got the weapons to be a starter. So it's very possible that like Trey Savage charts a similar course to the Blue Jays as Jake Bloss, who like was somewhat forced to the majors due to circumstance with Houston, but was clearly seen as someone who didn't need that much minor league seasoning before he was capable of getting big league hitters out.
Yeah, and he struggled in the majors. His three starts, I think he allowed 5 home runs. It's also such a reminder, too, that if you're a contending team and you debut your prospects, sometimes it's a showcase. And right. I don't know that the Astros were consciously trying to do that when they brought up Bloss, but just a reminder for next year, as I'm kind of making a mental note of this, but so often that'll happen. And it happened with the Jays back in like 2015 when it was Matt Boyd who came up very, very briefly. And I think Norris had been up for a couple seasons at that point. But sometimes that's a hint of, yeah, we think they're ready and you should too. So, you know, maybe we make a trade here.
Yeah, I remember when like Zach Logue got up randomly that one year and it was, okay. Right.
Sometimes it's a little bit of a tell.
I see what's going on here. So all that said, like hopefully expectations have been well framed for what I'm about to say, because this is one guy who I did actually want to dive a bit deeper on because he's really interesting to me. And multiple people have actually told me now that Pittsburgh was very reticent to give this guy up. And that's Charles McAdoo, who the Blue Jays acquired from Pittsburgh for Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. And important to remember, like the Blue Jays did not shop Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. They didn't go to Pittsburgh and say, hey, what will you give us for IKF? Like Pittsburgh came to the Blue Jays. They put this on the table and it crossed that line that I mentioned earlier where the Blue Jays had to very seriously consider it and then actually thought like, yeah, like Charles McAdoo, that's a guy who we really want. And like people with Pittsburgh really loved him. They didn't want to give him up. It could be one reason why that trade actually came so close to the deadline, because it took this kind of guy to motivate the Blue Jays to move IKF. But McAdoo described to me as a freak athlete. He played wide receiver and safety at De La Salle High School in California. It's like just east of Oakland. And that is just like an absolute powerhouse school in like California high school football. Like they sent a bunch of players to the NFL. Like Austin Hooper went there, Maurice Jones-Drew, TJ Ward, Amani Toomer, like a bunch of NFLers went there. So you got to be really good, really athletic to play on that team. McAdoo did, played both ways for them, ended up dedicating himself to baseball, like coming out of high school. He was super raw at first, but he has just made really quick, really large strides both in college and now as a pro. He actually had he went 2-for-4 against Paul Skeens in a game in college. If you go back and look it up.
Wow.
So like he's a really good player, man. Like he has a ton of athleticism that's transferred to like really big exit velos, and he's got really high bat speed. You can look at the minor league numbers. It's like video game stuff in hitters environments, mind you. But the belief is like he may just be scratching his potential. You know, like I think that, you know, a lot of people believe that like he has made these strides and he will continue to, and he will continue to get the absolute most out of himself because he's very motivated. He's a very hard worker. Someone put an 80 on his makeup for me. Like he is just kind of exactly the kind of guy that you want to bet on. So look, these are all these things and more could have been said about someone like Anthony Alford. And we all saw how that football to baseball, super athlete, high exit velo transition went. But you know, Charles McAdoo is the type of guy you want to bet on, and someone who I'm just going to be fascinated to see progress through the Blue Jays system.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I mean, the numbers are really good. You look at the minor league numbers this year, hitting .315 with a .932 OPS and 14 dingers, runs a little bit too. So this is a bat first, power first player, position kind of TBD. But hey, if he hits like anywhere close to this, then that's a major league bat, and that's really intriguing. And it's also, you know, I was thinking back to IKF and when and he'll help the Pirates, by the way. That's a nice pickup for them. And was really, really good in his time here in Toronto. And I was thinking back to when I wrote about his acquisition, and I said, hey, you know, IKF raises the floor for the Blue Jays, and hey, this isn't the splashiest acquisition, but he helps, and he helps them in a bunch of different ways. I just remember the comments like at that time, and you know, just the conversation around IKF and the frustration that the Blue Jays would go and get him, and like, why would they do this? And look, the Blue Jays have whiffed on a lot of moves, and those deserve to be criticized, but this particular one worked out really well. Like it was a really good signing, and it was a good pickup for the Blue Jays. And it's also a reminder too that when it comes to relievers, when it comes to bench players, like it's sometimes spending on those guys is a good thing. And going into this offseason, the Blue Jays really should spend on relievers. And if they're good, great. If they're not, if the relievers are good and the Blue Jays aren't, you can trade the relievers. You can get something back. And the IKF arc for the Blue Jays from free agent signing that was panned into really intriguing prospect and production on the field, it actually kind of worked out well.
116 WRC plus and 2 wins above replacement for Isaiah Kiner-Falefa in a Blue Jays uniform, 83 games. And the Blue Jays spent $15 million on that. Didn't even have to pay all of it because they end up moving the contract to Pittsburgh. They get that production from him, and then a pretty highly touted prospect in Charles McAdoo, who, you know, as you said, like a lot of people think this guy's going to be a big leaguer. You know, the Pirates believed he could stick at third. The Jays believe he can stick at third. If he doesn't, maybe he has to be a first baseman or an outfielder. But I mean, if he keeps progressing at the rate that he has since he turned pro offensively, it's somebody who I just think that you're going to see in the majors. So yeah, it's another reminder, not to judge anything too definitively in the moment. And also to like weigh the risk that's being taken on, because really like 2 years, $15 million for IKF, while it seemed like this overpay in the context of the market last year, and you know, your boy Ahmed Rosario going for 1.5 or
that's right. Dodgers got him again. They know talent when they see it.
Won the deadline right there.
That's right.
You know, or blanking on the third baseman who also went for 1.5, the former Blue
Jay. Gio Urshela,
right? Went for 1.5. So I get it in that context. But also, I mean, like that's to your point with the relievers and betting on players like IKF, like the risk is so low. It doesn't take much for those players to just outperform what you've outlaid for them. And sometimes you end up with situations like IKF. We've seen it just time and time again, where like the reaction to something that happens in the moment in baseball is like so strong in either direction, where like either this is the best thing that's ever happened or this is the worst thing that's ever happened. And typically like that initial reaction ends up disproven with time. Like it's always important just to like have a little patience, because baseball does take a long time to play out.
Oh, and you can put my reactions right in that bucket too. I'm no exception to that. We're human beings, right? Of course, you react to things in the moment. And there's some deals that I've thought are really great and, you know, just don't work out at all. And Like when the Jays signed Kirby Yates, I thought that was a great deal. I don't think he ever pitched an inning for them.
Not an inning, blew out his elbow in spring.
Yeah. So, you know, that error BNS right there. But, you know, there are other cases where you don't even really think about a move and then it becomes something greater. And so we don't know how it's going to unfold with all these prospects. I think when you buy 13 of them, plus Ryan Yarbrough, when you get 13, some will reach the majors, some will have some sort of impact in the major leagues. The scale of that impact, the timing of that impact, who knows? But it's a big haul. They added a lot, so some of those guys will pay off to some degree.
And it's a perfect transition into our final topic here, and that is Nate Pearson, who was like one of the more interesting deals at this deadline, because he has multiple years of control left, and he's like making less than $1 million this year, and he has all the potential in the world. And it's kind of funny to think, like, Blue Jays fans, rightly so, are very high on Jake Bloss right now, but Jake Bloss is not even half of the pitching prospect that Nate Pearson was. Like, Nate Pearson in 2020 and 2021, like, multiple prospect rankings sites had him as a top 10 prospect in the game, not just a top 10 pitcher, a top 10 prospect in baseball. And for the Blue Jays to end up getting only 115 big league innings out of him at a 5.21 ERA, and then trading him for a couple prospects who might end up as org guys, is just such a terrible outcome. It's just such a disappointing result of Nate Pearson's Blue Jays tenure. You know, these things go both ways, right? Like, sometimes IKF turns out being like an absolute home run, and then sometimes like a Nate Pearson, who a lot of people outside of Toronto believe is going to front your rotation for years and years to come and make millions of dollars and be this shutdown dude, sometimes he ends up being moved for a pretty paltry return because he was very quickly heading towards a potential DFA or a non-tender.
Yeah, this one is pretty tough. This is definitely a capital L for the Blue Jays organization to go from drafting him in the first round, developing him into a prospect for whatever that's worth, which is something because prospects have a lot of currency in the game, and then he just does not put it together. It wasn't even that he was always, I mean, there were injury issues, but it wasn't pure injury too. It just, the skill set was never materialized. The strike throwing was never there. The command never got to the point that it needed to be. This is a tough one. This is a tough look. And honestly, of all the trades the Blue Jays made, so they made 8 trades. Yep. If you line them up to me and said, Ben, do you think they're a good idea? I would say yes on 7 of them. And then on the Nate Pearson trade, even understanding that, okay, it's out the window. He's not going to be Justin Verlander, right? He's not going to be Gerrit Cole. So even understanding that, would I have accepted yes on the Nate Pearson for 2 org guys? No, I would not have done it. That's the one trade that I would not have done out of the 8 trades that they did. I thought that the 7 made sense. And look, I understand. I'm not saying that this is some sort of franchise-changing decision at this point. It once was that with the opportunity that they had there with that pick and that prospect, but not anymore. And I look at what they got back in a couple, you know, potential bench players, as you said, and I don't really see Josh Rivera or Yohendrick Panango as being enough to justify even trading away a reliever in the context of a team that doesn't have enough relief pitching.
Yeah, asking around, their names don't come up, you know, like they aren't super highly regarded. Like, you know, Panango's had his little mini breakout here after spending 4 years at high A.
So yeah, that's the thing.
I don't know. Maybe that continues. You know, Rivera was like a kind of polished guy coming out of college. Okay. You know, whatever. He's a shortstop, right? So there's got to be some athleticism there. But yeah, I agree with you in that sense, but I also think it just speaks to the fact that the Blue Jays were out of ideas with Nate, out of patience. He was out of options going into next year. And I think that if the Blue Jays didn't decide to cash in on what little value Pearson had at this time while they still could, I think that we probably would have seen him DFA'd or non-tendered between now and opening day 2025.
It's possible. I mean, I look at a 40-man roster with 5 open spots and I don't see a need to DFA him. And I look at a player who's making less than $1 million and I don't see the need to non-tender him. So I personally would have said, just play it out, bring him to spring. It's not like there are eight relievers that are clearly speaking for the bullpen spots right now. So even if he is out of options, so what? Put him in the back of the bullpen and see what happens. But this is all said within the context of, I don't think that this is a huge swing decision for this franchise. I don't think this is some sort of glaring error. I'm just sharing my personal opinion here.
Yeah.
That I would have kept Nate Pearson.
No, and I think all of your points are totally fair. And I think they're obviously all things that the Blue Jays recognized and thought about and still arrived at the conclusion that they did. So unless they see something in Yohandrick Pinongo that the rest of the world doesn't, I think it says more about where they were at with Nate Pearson than, you know, what they were thinking about the trade in a vacuum. And like I said, it's a disappointing outcome, right? Like the Blue Jays, like, look, these things happen with pitchers all the time, but the Blue Jays would like to consider themselves a strong developmental organization that can help pitchers get better. And you can't ask for like better raw stuff and tools as a pitcher, like a better frame, athleticism, delivery, physicality, like all that stuff, durability lately, obviously not earlier in his career, velo stuff, like the ability to pick up pitches quickly. You can't ask for more than Nate Pearson. Like, there were great building blocks there, and the Blue Jays just never quite could figure him out.
And his command must have gotten worse, right? Because if you put Nate Pearson in the minor leagues, he's not putting up good numbers now. He's not a top prospect now. Like, his physical skill set has deteriorated. So, and it's not just the velocity. He used to throw harder, but his command must have gotten worse too. Like, it's, and so we're not talking about someone who's going to go out there and become the next Emmanuel Class A or the next Edwin Diaz, even in a relief role. So, something happened there. I don't know, maybe it's just pitching and it's the attrition and that's part of it, but he really should be, the Blue Jays had such high hopes for him, and instead they're trading him for two minor league org guys who may or may not ever sniff the major leagues.
Yeah, like when he was coming up in 2017, 2018, 2019, he wasn't walking the world. You know, like, he was actually pretty dominant in the minor leagues. Like, for his career, his minor league numbers, he has 190 minor league innings, 243 strikeouts, only 68 walks. So, and only 16 home runs allowed in those 190 innings. He's allowed like more. So in the majors, he's thrown 117 innings, given up 23 home runs. In the minors, he threw 190, gave up only 16. So
yeah,
you're right. Like, something happened there. And this is also a guy who, like, already, like, him having to end up as a like medium leverage reliever in your bullpen was already a failure, considering that this is a guy who projected very well as a starter when he was a prospect. And like, look, like, we're kind of beating up on Nate right now. Like, I will always bet on Nate Pearson figuring it out one day, because his stuff is so exceptional, and like, his delivery is great. He's super smart about pitch design. Like I said, he picks up pitches remarkably quickly. Like, he learned a splitter this offseason, just like designed it in the lab, and just in very short amount of time was showing like a really effective splitter in spring training. I would not count out on him having like a Jeff Hoffman arc where at 29-30 something clicks and he figures it out. He has like this 60 inning season of like a 2 ERA and leverage for a good team, you know?
It wouldn't be a shock. And it could happen with the Cubs. I mean, he's going to be working there with Mike Sun, Dr. Mike Sun, a Canadian, who's their director of baseball science, I believe, or maybe it's just the baseball scientist. He's worked with Nate Pearson before closely. Those two know each other. They're going to get in the lab together, I'm sure, once Nate's done plunking whoever he faces. Oh. And that was entertaining. I'm sure they'll work together this offseason. I could see that happening. And that's pretty interesting. So I wouldn't rule anything out.
I think Nate's biggest issues the last couple of years, they weren't necessarily physical. They were more so mindset and mentality. And those are things that, like, that those can be kind of light switch things. Like, those are things that you can figure out very quickly. And if he does figure that stuff out, which a lot of pitchers have come to later into their careers, I think he could still be really, really good, because he has everything he needs, like, stuff wise to be a great pitcher in the majors. He just was not able to put it all together in Toronto, and that's a really, really poor outcome, considering what Nate Pearson projected to be when he entered this organization.
Yeah. Put it this way. I think that was a good trade for the Cubs. I like that trade for the Cubs.
All right. We should step away there because we've gone on long enough. But there was a lot to talk about when the Blue Jays, as Shai Davidi very astutely noted, he went back and like dug all this stuff up, made the most trades than they ever have at any deadline in franchise history. You were there for it, folks.
It was wild.
He's Ben Nicholson Smith. I'm Arden Zwelling. Our producers are Christian Ryan and Nick Ondrod. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time on At the Letters.